From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. An African-American woman in Fort Worth, Texas, called local police to report that someone had assaulted her 7-year-old son for littering. A white police officer arrived at the scene, but the situation quickly escalated, and the officer pinned Jacqueline Craig to the ground, arrested her and 2 of her children. Craig's cousin posted a video of the incident to Facebook. Well, the incident took place on Wednesday. Today, Craig is calling for justice. Here she is on CNN.
I had faith in the system at that point, which I don't anymore. So I'm just at a loss for words because I wouldn't have expected what happened to happen.
The officer has not been officially identified, but the Fort Worth Police Department says he has been placed on restrictive duty. For more now, let's turn to Lee Williams. He's managing editor for news at the Star-Telegram in Fort Worth. And Lee, what do we specifically know about what happened?
Well, really all we know right now is what we've seen on the video, and the police were called, and the police officer and the mom started having a discussion. And I think this is what is really important in this is that, and you can hear this clearly on the video, and it's at one point the police officer asked the mom, why don't you teach your son not to litter? And the mom responded, he can't prove to me that my son littered, but it doesn't matter if he did or didn't. It doesn't give him the right to put his hands on him. And then the officer responded, why not? And I think that is a very important part of this story because it just kind of set everything into motion after that. That's when it really escalated, when he responded, why not? And to me, that's the big question is why would a police officer respond like that in that situation?
And what are the Fort Worth police or the police department saying then?
Well, I mean, right now they're essentially saying we are investigating this. We're aware of the situation and an attorney who represents police officers, including the one in question here, has already said, please do not rush to judgment. There's a lot more to this that is probably not seen on the video.
Right. So, in fact, we're seeing that the lawyer has said, it is shameful that there's an immediate rush to judgment that my client is a racist cop simply because of the color of his skin. So, I mean, is that what people in Fort Worth, has race become the dominant issue here in this incident?
Well, I think it certainly has moved that direction. And again, I think it's more of a situation of a police officer exercising his authority and his power against African Americans in a situation that did not need to escalate to the level it did. I think anyone who watches the video says this appears to be completely unnecessary. So I think that's where a lot of people are saying racism comes into play. We have been very careful not to say that. We say that there are people who have drawn that conclusion. It's just different. It's something that haven't seen anything like this here in a long time.
And so, I mean, this is coming at a time where it was just in July where there was that terrible killing of 5 police officers in Dallas.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit more about community policing, that Fort Worth stepped up its efforts to do community policing after that.
Well, yeah. After that incident in Dallas, Fort Worth doubled up on patrol as a safety measure and had 2 people riding all the time. And one of the reasons an expert told us that is good is that if there's a situation that becomes volatile, that one officer can talk down the other one and say, hey, how is the best way to handle this? Well, now it's voluntary for officers to ride in pairs, and in this situation, this officer was acting alone and had no one to talk to and was making the decision himself. So I think that's kind of one of the things that is interesting about this case.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess we'll have to wait and see, but you have to wonder why any police officer would think it's okay to tell a mother that someone else could touch their child against her will. I mean, we'll have to wait and see about...
Right. And the other thing is that part of the case is almost lost in this. So to me, it's almost like there are 2 stories here. It's like, well, so what happens with that case? I'm assuming that the information will be presented to a grand jury here or at least the district attorney's office, and they will make the decision on where to pursue charges against the man who is accused of telling this kid to quit littering and, you know, allegedly touching him. So we'll just kind of have to see on that.
Well, Lee Williams is managing editor for news at the Star-Telegram in Fort Worth, Texas. Mr. Williams, thank you so very much.
Thank you, and you'll have a happy holiday.
Well, today marks something of a modern tradition in Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke to reporters in a marathon year-end news conference. Putin said he saw nothing unusual in President-elect Donald Trump's promise to strengthen the U.S. nuclear arsenal. This comes just before another important day in Russia. 25 years ago, on Christmas, Mikhail Gorbachev stepped down as president of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet hammer and sickle flag flew above the Kremlin for the last time. Chris Miller is with the Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy at Yale University. And Chris, just remind us, what was going on that led to Gorbachev's resignation and the end of the Soviet Union?
So in 1991, there was a coup against Gorbachev in the middle of the year in August, where the military stood up and tried to topple Gorbachev. And that coup was defeated not by Gorbachev himself, but by the leader of the Russian Republic, which was one of the 15 republics that made up the Soviet Union, whose name was Boris Yeltsin.
Right.
And what that did was shift power away from Gorbachev, who was the lawful president of the Soviet Union, towards not only Yeltsin, but all of the other republic-level leaders in the Soviet Union. And so as the year progressed, what happened was all of the lower-level leaders started taking power from Gorbachev. And by the time he reached December, Gorbachev found that he hardly had any power left at all.
And so he steps down on Christmas Day 1991, which must have been a monumental day for the entire world.
Well, it was a monumental day for the entire world. It was also a day full of misgiving about the future for the people who lived in the countries that were now the former Soviet Union, countries that weren't sure how they would relate to each other going forward, and countries which were all in the midst of a pretty terrible economic crisis that had persisted for the previous couple of years but continued throughout the 1990s.
As you say, 15 new countries. I won't name them all, but you've got places like Belarus, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan. You know, when people think about the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of people might equate it to the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. But obviously, those are different events. How are they connected?
Well, from the perspective of the West, people in the United States or in European countries, the most important event was the end of the Cold War. And that's symbolized, I think, by the fall of the Berlin Wall. Obviously, the end of the Soviet Union played a role in that as well. But for people who were living in the countries that emerged from the USSR, it was far more significant that their country fell apart. That's what they see as the fundamental change that happened during that period.
And yet, I've seen some polls recently that say many Russians regret the collapse of the Soviet Union, that in fact they sort of have this nostalgic feeling for the Soviet Union. Why would that be?
Well, when people today in Russia look back at the Soviet Union, they remember a country that was victorious over the Nazis in World War II, which indeed the Soviet Union was, and also which provided a baseline of economic stability from the end of World War II until the mid-1980s. People were guaranteed to have basic things covered, their food, they were guaranteed to have a job, things like that. Whereas once the Soviet Union collapsed and the economic crisis began to pick up steam, those things were all called into question. And so some people emerged much better off from the Soviet Union's collapse, but a lot of people looking back aren't so sure that they did.
Gorbachev is still alive. How do people feel about him today?
Well, it depends a lot on who you ask. There's certainly a small section of the Russian intelligentsia that looks upon him very fondly. One of the leading Soviet newspapers on the day that Gorbachev finally resigned wrote that Gorbachev didn't know how to make sausage, but he knew how to give us freedom. And there's certainly a group of Russians who think that still applies. But I would say that most Russians, when you speak to them today, focus not on the giving of freedom, but on the failure to make sausage and remember him more as a leader who failed to provide the increases in living standards that he promises.
And what about Gorbachev's feelings about the current Russian president, Vladimir Putin? Does he talk about him?
He does. Gorbachev is still a fairly active participant in Russian political debates. He's been a critic of some of the more anti-democratic tendencies of Vladimir Putin. But Putin, I think his policies have been very much shaped by the lessons that he drew from the Soviet Union's collapse, the dangers of economic crisis, not only for the population, but also for the rulers of the country. And the lesson that he's applied in his own government today is that you must not lose control over the government's power to tax and spend, because if you do that, then you lose control of the political system too.
Well, look, for people who were not paying close attention at the time, maybe because they were too young or simply weren't alive, could you just reflect on the importance of the collapse of the Soviet Union today?
Well, it's easy to forget what a tremendous role the Soviet Union played in international politics for the entire post-war period. It was geographically the world's largest country. It was for a long time seen as a superpower competitor to the United States. It was the country with one of the two largest arsenals of nuclear weapons, and it, along with the United States, shaped the contours of the Cold War for nearly two generations. And so the end of the Soviet Union, its demise into 15 different states, helped end the Cold War. But it also shaped the lives of all the people who lived in the Soviet Union, the generation that's lived through the post-Soviet period in Russia and the other former Soviet states. Often don't even realize the extent to which their lives are drastically different than those of their parents just because the political system has changed so drastically.
Is life better in Russia now than it was for people in the Soviet Union?
Well, if you look at any, I think, objective indicator, whether a political freedom indicator or an economic well-being indicator, the answer would be yes. I think if you ask the average Russian, there's a whole lot of nostalgia that they have when they look back at the Soviet period.
Huh. Chris Miller is Associate Director of the Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy at Yale University and author of Collapse, The Struggle to Save the Soviet Economy. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With Christmas Eve and the first night of Hanukkah tomorrow night, kitchens around the country will be working overtime. But what are some of the do's and don'ts of roasting meats and vegetables? Recently, Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst joined Jeremy Hobson in our studios for a roasting lesson.
Kathy, great to see you.
Hi, Jeremy.
And roasting just seems to be something we do a lot more as the weather gets colder, but maybe we don't do it so well. So what are some of the big mistakes people make?
I got to tell you, years ago, I wrote a book called Roasting, and I have been obsessed with this method of cooking ever since. So let's just define it first. And that's actually easier said than done. Mm. You'll see like a recipe called roast chicken, and it'll say bake the chicken. And you're like, wait, bake or roast? What is it? So roasting is the action of cooking something in an oven. How's that for a generic description? But it also has to do with a hot and dry type of heat and cooking method. So in other words, it's not a ton of liquid. It's not a super low temperature. Usually you're talking about a hot oven and something that's dry because you want the heat of the oven to sear whatever it is that you're roasting. But we will get into that.
Well, and baking, by the way, would be what then?
Well, this is where it gets super murky. Honestly, I think it's semantics, but you bake a cake, you bake a pie, you roast a chicken, you roast a standing rib roast,
okay.
Which I want to just come clean right now and say I did not do for you.
Oh,
I know.
I saw that there was no roast here.
There's no roast meat there, but I have a beautiful recipe for you for a standing rib roast, which is sort of the ultimate Christmas or New Year's feast, you know, some gorgeous, gorgeous cut of meat, hopefully locally raised, sustainably raised, organically raised. Have I hit every buzzword there?
Yes.
But honestly, the key to a good standing rib roast for the holidays is just fabulous meat, salt and pepper, and a very high temperature to begin. And then often with roasting, what you do is you start it high and you reduce it to a lower temperature again, so you get that beautiful, crisp, golden brown crackly crust.
And we will put your recipe for the standing rib roast that you didn't make me at hereandnow.org. But Kathy, I just want to go back to
I need to change the title. The standing rib roast I didn't make you. Okay.
It's an original.
Yes.
The mistakes that people make, what are some of the big ones?
I think one of the biggest one has to do with the first step, which is choosing a roasting pan. If you have a roasting pan where the sides are very high, more than a few inches, you're going to steam the food. What's going to happen is the sides of the pan are going to sort of trap the heat, and it's going to create moisture in the bottom of the pan as opposed to having hot, dry heat that's circulating all around. So you want a really large roasting pan, and you don't want the sides of it to be super high. You always want a pan that's bigger than the amount of food that you're cooking. Once you start crowding a roasting pan, again, steam is created. It gets crowded. Things are pushing up against each other. You can't get that beautiful brown caramelization that you want from roasting. So those are two things. A lot of people forget to preheat their oven. It sounds so basic. Mm. But with roasting, you want to put whatever it is. And I want to say right now, you can roast vegetables, fish, fruit, obviously poultry of all kinds, and beef and pork of all kinds, and wild game. You don't want to put too much into a pan. Also, you don't want, this is a big mistake people make, they're like, oh, cool, what if I added some wine, or what if I added some water to the bottom of the pan? Again, you're going to start braising the food as opposed to roasting it, which is wonderful. But if what you're after is a really nicely roasted piece of whatever it is, don't add a lot of liquid.
And here's another one that I've learned recently, which is that tenting makes a big difference after you're done with the roast in the oven.
I'm so glad you brought that up, she says sarcastically. I know you wanted to talk about tenting, and I did a lot of research. In fact, you hear that? I printed out some 40.
You've got a book in front of you,
I do.
Basically.
I'm going to write the Tent Cookbook, and the subtitle is going to be Don't Do It. And here's
don't
why.
Don't tent.
Do not. Here's why. So what do you think tenting? I mean, this is when you put foil on after
you've
roasted something.
You put foil on the top of it to try to, what, retain the moisture.
Yeah, to try to what? That's exactly it right there. The reason most people tent is they take something out of the oven and then they think, because we're told this over and over, let it sit.
Right.
That's a good idea, but not for too long. So people think, okay, let's just take a huge piece of foil and let's tent it over the thing. So what happens if I wrap something up tightly? Again, it starts to steam. If I have a gorgeous roast goose or roast duck for the holidays, and it has this gorgeous skin on it, and I put foil on top of it, it's going to collapse. It's going to ruin all the beautiful effects of roasting. Loosely tenting something. So for instance, a turkey. Sometimes the legs will brown before the breast, or the breast will brown before the dark meat. And you might want to loosely tent that part of the bird. That's okay if it's getting too brown. But if you're doing it because you think it's going to keep the meat or the vegetables warmer longer, it's not. Try this. Next time you put a piece of foil on something, touch the foil after just a few minutes. It's not going to be hot anymore. It's not really doing a job, and what it's going to do is create steam, and you're going to lose it. So tenting, not so much.
All right. We learned something new right there, but let's talk about this food that you did make, Kathy, in front of us.
Really good.
It smells great, and let's start with this carrot dish.
Okay. So I thought that I wanted to sort of do a roasting light. Yes, we can talk about rib roast, but roasting vegetables. When I wrote this book in the 90s, people were not roasting vegetables. Now it's on every menu. These are beautiful, whole, very slender carrots that I roasted whole with pomegranate molasses and maple syrup. And then I added, after I took it out, after it gets just cooked through and kind of a sweet glaze.
You tent it.
No, you do not tent it. Have you learned nothing? What you do once you've taken it out of the oven, once it's just starting to cool off a little bit, is sprinkle it with fresh pomegranate seeds. So you get that gorgeous jeweled look of the seeds and a sweet crunch, which I always like.
You also have a roasted fish dish
here. I do.
Here.
People don't think of roasting fish as much as they think of roasting meat and vegetables. So first what I did was I cut two fennel bulbs up. Fennel is slightly licorice flavor. I adore fennel. I thinly sliced it. I tossed it with some olive oil, salt and pepper, and some peeled shallots. You could do onions also. And I roasted that for about 10 minutes at high heat. Then I add this beautiful piece of cod in the middle of all the fennel and the shallots and added some garlic and herb butter on top and roasted that. And then a tiny bit of breadcrumbs on top. And I think you get the roasted flavors in the shallots, the fennel, and the fish. And they're all kind of different.
When you're roasting something, if you need the oven for something else, can you share it or is that a bad idea?
Can you share it? It sounds like a shower. Of course you can share it. But like the classic is if you're doing a big holiday roast, you do want to take it out before you want to eat. You do want to let it sit. You do not want to tightly tent it. And then you can use the oven for all your other dishes. But most people's ovens won't fit a huge turkey or a goose or a duck or rib roast, plus all the vegetables you want to cook. So yeah, you can sneak some things in around the sides. But often while you're letting some roasted, beautiful dish sit, you can throw all your other ingredients in.
All right. Well, we will put all these recipes at our website, hereandnow.org. As always, Kathy Gunst, resident chef and author of her new book, Soup Swap, Comforting Recipes to Make and Share. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, this is also the time of year when many families welcome kids home from college. After busy fall semesters, they come back to the roost with all their stuff. Sometimes that includes dirty laundry and always a pile of friends to stop by to reconnect. 5 days after his daughter came back, Dan Howard of Maine took to YouTube to share his thoughts about his daughter's homecoming. And he's happy, of course, to have her home. But, here's a bit of his viral video.
It's the Christmas season, and we love to have her. I mean, it's really great to have her home from college. Day two was interesting. She had friends over late night, and about 3 a.m, they decided to bake cookies and cupcakes and everything else, and it was so cute listening to their voices. I probably slept an hour, and they left everything out. Next morning I woke up, and even the milk was left out. It was sour. Those rascals. But such nice kids. Great having them home.
Those rascals.
And we've got one more Christmas or holiday note here. Here in our studios, we actually have the WBUR employee who we believe has the best, ugliest Christmas or holiday sweater of the year. And it goes to Jamie Bologna. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
Can you describe your sweater? Because it's quite a work of art.
So it's this purely acrylic green sweater with a red house and a chimney on top. And it has a little Santa Claus that dances.
But the Santa Claus dances because you insert your phone into the sweater.
Help! Help! Ho, ho, help! Darn those carbs.
Right, insert your phone into the sweater, and then it's a picture of Santa Claus's two legs going side by side, and he's stuck in the chimney because he had too many carbs.
It's the ultimate in Christmas wearables, right?
Like exactly. This is the Internet of Things.
Do you wear that in public?
I wore it in public this morning at Dunkin' Donuts. They gave me coffee and said, get out of here.
WBUR's Jamie Bologna, congratulations on your win for the ugliest, best ugliest Christmas sweater in the building today.
Thanks.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. .com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Today, financial giants Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse have agreed to pay a combined $12.5 billion in a deal reached with the U.S. government. The banks were accused of peddling the toxic debt that played a big role in the American financial crisis back in 2008. And just for good measure, the Justice Department says it's also suing Barclays for fraud. Mike Regan is here. He's a senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Peter.
So, at least for Deutsche Bank, this settlement could have been much, much worse. Tell us about the deals.
Right. It's a very big deal for Deutsche Bank because they're only paying $7.2 billion. And I know that sounds like a lot, but originally the Justice Department was demanding $14 billion. And that amount was so large that it started to raise questions about whether Deutsche Bank would actually be able to pay the fine and still be able to pay off its bondholders on time. So that became very much a source of agita in financial markets. And this basically relieves that a big cloud of concern over Deutsche Bank.
Well, like many things these days, there is a Donald Trump connection here. There were some concerns about a conflict of interest that the president-elect would have with Deutsche Bank because it has lent him a lot of money over the years, including for that old post office development in Washington, D.C. What about that? Does this close the book on that conflict of interest potential?
Yeah, right. It's not a juicy financial story unless Trump is involved somehow. But yeah, basically the Trump organization owes Deutsche Bank about $30 million in debt. And the way it was structured was that Donald Trump himself made a personal pledge. In other words, if you know the organization could not pay off, then the loan would be backed by him personally. And what Deutsche Bank is trying to do is restructure the debt to get rid of that personal pledge and therefore reduce any perceived conflict of interest between the loan and his presidency. And you know that's underway now. The bank is saying basically it doesn't believe it'll receive preferential treatment from Trump after he takes office. But obviously it wants to, you know, get rid of any appearance of conflict of interest.
Yeah. Well, you know, these banks have a lot of money in reserve. I'm reading that Deutsche Bank has $220 billion in reserve funds. So, you know, this really is a drop in the bucket. But is there, you know, is it safe to say that these agreements actually are good for the banks? Let them move on with their lives, so to speak?
Yeah, I think there's an argument to be made that they are good, not only, you know, settling them, allowing the banks to move on, But also, you know, it basically forces banks to try to prevent this type of thing from happening again. But that said, the bankers in many cases do have some valid complaints. If you remember back to the financial crisis, many of the big banks agreed to take over other firms that were basically on the verge of bankruptcy. And, you know, many of these deals were sort of shotgun marriages, either encouraged or outright brokered by the government. And then later the government turned around and demanded big penalties from the banks for behavior of these banks that they took over basically as a favor for the government. So, you know, the banks are a little, you know, Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan especially has made that point, saying, look, you know, there is a little bit of sour grapes over that.
Yeah. Probably also worth noting that we're just in the final weeks of the Obama administration, so perhaps him trying to cement his legacy here, putting this chapter in the United States behind us. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thanks and happy holidays to you.
Thank you, Peter. You too.
In August, we broadcast this show from Yellowstone National Park to mark the 100th anniversary of the Park Service. And we found out that people in Yellowstone are serious about bear safety, for good reason. I spoke with a nearby rancher who knows firsthand what it's like to be in the jaws of a grizzly.
3 years ago, June 20th, 2013.
It was a beautiful morning on Nick Patrick's family ranch about 40 miles outside of Yellowstone.
So I run a few cattle and horses and grow a little hay and just repair everything that is fallen down.
Out on the South Fork of the Shoshone River, Patrick has a view of 10,000-foot peaks. Dense thickets of willows and cottonwoods stand tall on his land.
If you went up this road to the end of it and then got on a horse, you could ride over into Jackson.
Some might call this God's country, but on that day in June, 3 years ago, it was also grizzly country. Patrick was working down near the trees, irrigating his crops.
Which I've done for 50 years. And as I was doing that, I heard my little dog, who's usually by my side, just screaming, entangled up with something. And I'd been in some epic raccoon dog battles in that same spot. So like a fool, I rushed around the corner and yelled, "Hey," and immediately saw that 25 feet away from me was a sow grizzly with two little bitty cubs. And she just looked at me, said, "You're next," and she was on me within 3 or 4 seconds.
I was going to ask what was going through your mind when you saw the sow 25 feet from you, but I wonder if you even had time to think.
Yeah, I had an irrigating shovel. I had time to cock that and slam her in the head with that as she came in, but it didn't do any good. And actually, it kind of left me exposed because I didn't have my hands up because of the swing. And so the first thing she did was reach up and bite me in the face. And then it was just a melee from there. And it's kind of like other prey animals. You kind of go into a suspended ant. You don't really feel any pain, you can feel pressure, but she at one point grabbed me by my left knee and dragged me about 20 feet and bit me through the hand, and then she finally decided she'd, I guess, taught me a lesson, and she took off. Unfortunately, she took off in the wrong direction where her cubs were. I could hear her coming back down the hill and grunting, and she tied into me again.
It's almost impossible to imagine, but Patrick says if you want to know what it's like to be rendered powerless by a 600-pound grizzly, there is a way to do it. Watch a 2015 film called The Revenant, and this haunting scene when a frontiersman played by Leonardo DiCaprio is walking through the woods and then suddenly is in the jaws of a massive mother bear.
That's exactly what it was like.
At that point, like when you got after the second time, did you think that you had survived it? Or, I mean, did you feel like you were still in major trouble physically?
Oh, the second time she came back, I had that feeling that, you know, if this is what you're here for, get it over with, because I've had it. I've had all of this I want.
The bear didn't want to kill Patrick because, of course, she could have. She bit through his hand and through his knee and left an open wound across his face. He wears a prosthesis today where his nose used to be. It's a shocking story and a rare one. Kerry Gunther says you're as likely to be killed by lightning.
Well, we average over 4 million visits a year, and we average one bear attack per year. So the odds overall are pretty low.
Gunther is Yellowstone's bear biologist, and we met outside his office in front of the towering Mount Everts. Gunther can put Patrick's attack in perspective because he's been tracking grizzlies around here for more than three decades.
When I first started working in Yellowstone Park, it was pretty rare to see a grizzly bear. So if you saw a dozen bears in a summer, you considered that a pretty good bear year. Today, you can easily see a dozen bears in one morning.
So were there like a handful of them 30 years ago, and now how many? Do you have any estimates of how many there are?
Well, there's possibly as few as 136 in 1975, and now we believe there's well over 700.
That's because the federal government listed the grizzly as a threatened species in 1975. And ever since then, it's protected the bear from hunters and ranchers who took matters into their own hands when grizzlies devoured their livestock. But with their numbers rebounding, there's talk of delisting the bears. Is this something that you think about more often now because there are so many more grizzly bears in the park?
Yes, we're working on our safety messaging because there's a lot more bears and visitation keeps increasing, so there's a lot more people. So we're having more encounters, and we're trying to get better at teaching people how to avoid having surprise encounters in the first place and then how to react if they do have a surprise encounter.
So here's a crash course, Grizzly 101, by Yellowstone professor Carrie Gunther.
One of the easiest things to do is find at least two friends to hike with. We almost never get anyone attacked that's hiking in a group of three or more. Bears respect things that are bigger than they are and that outnumber them.
Really, two is not enough.
Two is not enough. Two is better than one, but three is better than two. Now, if you do have a surprise encounter, initially what we recommend is slowly backing away, because a lot of times that'll diffuse the situation, shows the bear that you're really not a threat to those cubs. But if the bear charges, you want to stop and stand your ground. Just by standing your ground, most of the time the bear's going to veer off if it charges or stop short. Standing your ground is important.
Okay, Carrie, but I want to interrupt you there because the thought of standing your ground when a grizzly bear, you know, several hundred pound animal is charging at you, every fiber of your being is going to be telling you to run the other direction, and you say you've just got to put your shoes in the ground and stay put.
Yes. And, you know, when I first started working here over 30 years ago, that was a pretty tough thing to do. It took a lot of courage. Now, today there's a product, Bear Spray, that's over 90% effective at stopping aggressive behavior in bears. And one of the big things with Bear Spray, it gives people the courage to stand their ground. Carrying Bear Spray is a real important thing.
And I see you've got some Bear Spray in a holster on your hip right there.
If it's in your pack, again, a bear's going to be charging at about 44 feet per second. You don't have time to take a pack off and get Bear Spray out of a pocket. So you want to have it on a holster, either on your chest or on your hip, where you can get to it immediately.
What is it? It's just like pepper spray for bears?
It's a hot pepper spray for bears. It comes out in a really fine mist, so it gets into their eyes. They breathe it in, fills the lungs. The same type of product used by law enforcement, but it's a hotter concentration, and it comes out in a big cloud, so you don't have to even be a good aim to use it. You just have to get it out, get the safety tab off, and press the trigger.
You got to do all that while your hands are shaking and while you've got a bear charging right down at you.
That's right. And so you want to practice ahead of time so that when the bear charges, it's instinctual that you know exactly what to do.
Okay, well, should we practice?
Let's practice.
Okay.
Yeah, let's see which way the wind's going here. This way. So I take the top of the holster off. You want to aim slightly downward. The bear, again, is coming in at about 44 feet per second. If you aim too high, it could run right underneath before that bear spray can settle down. So I aim just slightly downward, press the trigger.
Whoa.
And the bear just has to run through it. And as the bear's running through it, you just keep spraying right into the bear's face.
Okay, so the spray really gets like what? I'm taking one, two, three steps here, and it seems... A little bit of it in.
And it's still out there. It's expanding as it goes out, so it's harder to see, but it's drifting out there about 30 feet.
By the way, that bear spray was just for practice. It wasn't the real thing. So even if it did get caught in my lungs, it wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been. So note to self, don't walk into the cloud of bear spray after you pull the trigger. Anyway, Nick Patrick, the rancher who was mauled outside the park, says bear spray might have helped him if he had it, but he didn't. He says it was his fault for being unprepared, and for sure, he does not blame the animal.
I knew the bears around here. I've been an advocate for the grizzlies for, you know, over 40 years. All she was doing is what any good mother would have done. She was just taking on the next comer because she had an agenda, and that was keeping her baby safe. That's her job. grizzlies define wildness. And if we can have that, can you know, that in our ecosystem, if we can support grizzlies and they can live here and thrive here, then we're doing something right. We're keeping this country in good shape.
And that's pretty big of a man who knows what it's like to feel incredibly small in this wild country. And there is an update to this story. About 2 months after it aired, a man hiking nearby in the Montana backcountry was attacked by a grizzly sow. Todd Orr says he had 2 cans of bear spray and he used it, but it didn't stop the attack. Orr was seriously injured, but able to hike to safety. It's Here and Now.
There's been a lot of great television this year. Stranger Things, Atlanta, and The People vs. O.J. Simpson, to name a few. But what about great programs that you might not have heard of? Joining us now with his picks is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
So, first of all, before we get to your specific picks, there was so much TV this year, so much great new content. Does more equal more good stuff as well?
Fortunately, it does. It hasn't always been that way in television. 10, 15 years ago, more television would have just meant more mediocre television. But I think the bar has been raised, and we've seen a lot of really good shows, especially debut in 2016. And there's a lot of TV outlets out there like Hulu and Amazon and Crackle that are trying to build their brand around quality content. So they're not just putting shows out there to put them out there. They're putting shows out there that are intended to be high quality, that they've spent money on, that have stars in them, that have real creative forces and things to say. And now whether or not they resonate for people or how much they resonate is the question, but they are shooting for quality. And so that means that we get a much better field with a lot more high quality shows.
Well, let's talk about a couple shows that maybe people haven't heard of, but meet that quality criteria on your sharing. The first one you wanted to talk about, I understand, is a Netflix documentary called Hip Hop Evolution. It's about the beginnings of rap. We've got a clip here from the trailer, so let's listen to that.
Everybody was like, you ready to grapple with these sheriffs and LAPD around here? You ready to do that? And I'm like, man, we got to do something.
I just remember the FBI going, you can't rap this. Yeah, we can. Like, we gonna stop us?
Eric, I have to say, it was just the other day that my Netflix served this up as something I might like, and I immediately put it in my list. I was like, why hadn't I seen this before?
I know. What it really is, if you've seen Netflix's The Get Down, which is a scripted show about the beginnings of hip-hop, this is like the documentary analog to that. They talk about these legendary house parties. They talk about how hip-hop style evolved, and you really get a sense of sort of being there and experiencing it. And for those of us of a certain age, it will actually remind us of our teenage years or our tween years and bring back a lot of great memories.
Hey, great memories and great music, too, I have to say.
Exactly.
Well, let's turn to another show that I hadn't heard of until I found out that it was on your list. It's called Chewing Gum, a British comedy about a young person of faith who wants to lose her virginity and learn more about the world. We've got a clip of it here, and you'll hear actress Michaela Cole. She stars as Tracy Gordon, and she's speaking to her boyfriend. They've been together for more than 6 years, but they haven't had more carnal relations yet. And she's in the scene, she's trying to seduce him by doing things that her friends have told her to do.
No, okay, I'm just scared, Ron. Yeah, we've been going out since I was 17, and we haven't done anything. I don't think it's normal. I haven't kissed you, I haven't held you, I haven't sat on your face.
Why would you sit on my face?
I'm not sure.
Tell us about this show.
Well, you get a sense of the attitude of the show. It's a little bit absurdist, right? And we're used to these comedies about young women trying to find their way in the world in an urban environment. You know, you think about Girls, even Insecure on HBO. But this is very British. And it's featuring a black woman who is the daughter of immigrants. And so it's about the immigrant experience in Britain. It's about the class system in Britain. It's about what happens when you're raised to be very religious, and so you're very innocent about things like sex and even romance. It's just a great little comedy that's very quirky, very eccentric, but very funny and very sort of specific and individual. And I really loved it when I stumbled on it.
So this is Chewing Gum. And where can U.S. audiences see it?
It's on Netflix.
It is on Netflix, too. Okay, so there's two wins for Netflix there. Finally, let's switch streaming services here because you want to talk about Amazon's Goliath. This stars Billy Bob Thornton, right?
Yeah, exactly. Billy Bob Thornton plays this sort of alcoholic attorney, but this case falls into his lap that pits him against this mega successful law firm that he helped found and got kicked out of. It's written by David E. Kelley, who created The Practice and Boston Legal and a lot of great television shows about the law on network television. Here, they get to curse. You know, they can be a little more explicit, but it's also it's professional. These guys have done this for a while, and Billy Bob Thornton is really great as this attorney. And his foil is William Hurt, who's also an amazing actor. So there's a lot of great acting, a lot of great lines. The storyline is a bit conventional, but you'll have a lot of fun getting there.
Well, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans serving up to us three more shows to binge watch in these long winter nights. Eric,
exactly. You know, you guys up in Boston when you're kicking back and the snow's outside, you know, just fire up the streamer and check out some of these shows.
Can't think of anything better. Eric, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Boston or anywhere, because the nights are technically long across the country. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Happy holidays from us at Here and Now.